you all who freed them. Lord, not I, dearie, laughed the main woman. I never saw a nigger till I came south last month, and I don't care if I never see another. They give me the creeps. I wouldn't trust one of them. For some moments, Scarlet had been conscious that Uncle Peter was breathing hard and sitting up very straight as he stared steadily at the horse's ears. Her attention was called to him more forcibly when the main woman broke off suddenly with a laugh and pointed him out to her companions. "Look at that old nigger swell up like a toad," she giggled. "I'll bet he's an old pet of yours, isn't he? You Southerners don't know how to treat niggers. You spoil them to death." Peter sucked in his breath, and his wrinkled brow showed deep furrows. But he kept his eyes straight ahead. He had never had the term nigger applied to him by a white person in all his life. By other Negroes, yes, but never by a white person. And to be called untrustworthy and an old pet, he, Peter, who had been the dignified mainstay of the Hamilton family for years. Scarlet felt, rather than saw, the black chin begin to shake with hurt pride, and a killing rage swept over her. She had listened with calm contempt while these women had underrated the Confederate army, blackguarded Jeff Davis, and accused Southerners of murder and torture of their slaves. If it were to her advantage, she would have endured insults about her own virtue and honesty. But the knowledge that they had hurt the faithful old darky with their stupid remarks fired her like a match in gunpowder. For a moment, she looked at the big horse pistol in Peter's belt, and her hands itched for the feel of it. They deserved killing, these insolent, ignorant, arrogant conquerors. But she bit down on her teeth until her jaw muscles stood out, reminding herself that the time had not yet come when she could tell the Yankees just what she thought of them. Some day, yes. My God, yes. But not yet. Uncle Peter is one of our family, she said, her voice shaking. Good afternoon. Drive on, Peter. Peter laid the whip on the horse so suddenly that the startled animal jumped forward as the buggy jounced off. Scarlet heard the main woman say with puzzled accents, "Her family? You don't suppose she meant a relative? He's exceedingly black." God damn them. They ought to be wiped off the face of the earth. If ever I get money enough, I'll spit in all their faces. She glanced at Peter and saw that a tear was trickling down his nose. Instantly a passion of tenderness, of grief for his humiliation, swamped her, made her eyes sting. It was as though someone had been senselessly brutal to a child. Those women had hurt Uncle Peter. Peter, who had been through the Mexican War with old Colonel Hamilton. Peter, who had held his master in his arms when he died, who had raised Melly and Charles and looked after the feckless, foolish Pitypat, protected her when she refugeed, and acquired a horse to bring her back from Macon through a war-torn country after the surrender. And they said they wouldn't trust niggers. Peter, she said, her voice breaking as she put her hand on his thin arm. I'm ashamed of you for crying. What do you care? They aren't anything but damn Yankees. They talked in front of me like I was a mule and couldn't understand them. Like I was a African and didn't know what they was talking about, said Peter, giving a tremendous sniff. And they call me a nigger. And Em ain't never been called a nigger by no white folks. And they call me an old pet, and they say that niggers ain't to be trusted. Me not to be trusted? Why, when the old colonel was dying, he say to me, "You, Peter, you looked after my children. Take care of your young Miss Pitypat," he say, "'cause she ain't got no more sense than a hop of grass." and I done take care of her good all these years." "Nobody but the angel Gabriel could have done better," said Scarlet soothingly. "We just couldn't have lived without you."
"Yes'm. Thank you kindly, ma'am. I knows it, and you knows it. But them Yankee folks don't know it, and they don't want to know it."
"How come they come mixing in our business, Miss Scarlet?"
"They don't understand us Confederates."
Scarlet said nothing, for she was still burning with a wrath she had not exploded in the Yankee women's faces. The two drove home in silence. Peter's sniffle stopped, and his underlip began to protrude gradually until it stuck out alarmingly. His indignation was mounting, now that the initial hurt was subsiding. Scarlet thought, what damnably queer people Yankees are. Those women seemed to think that because Uncle Peter was black, he had no ears to hear with and no feelings, as tender as their own, to be hurt. They didn't know that Negroes had to be handled gently, as though they were children, directed, praised, petted, scolded. They didn't understand Negroes, or the relations between the Negroes and their former masters. Yet they had fought a war to free them. And having freed them, they didn't want to have anything to do with them, except to use them to terrorize Southerners. They didn't like them, didn't trust them, didn't understand them. And yet their constant cry was that Southerners didn't know how to get along with them. Not trust a darkie. Scarlet trusted them far more than most white people, certainly more than she trusted any Yankee. There were qualities of loyalty and tirelessness and love in them that no strain could break, no money could buy. She thought of the faithful few who remained at Tara in the face of the Yankee invasion, when they could have fled or joined the troops for lives of leisure. But they had stayed. She thought of Dilsey toiling in the cotton fields beside her, of Pork risking his life in neighboring hen houses that the family might eat, of Mammy coming to Atlanta with her to keep her from doing wrong. She thought of the servants of her neighbors who had stood loyally beside their white owners, protecting their mistresses while the men were at the front, refugeeing with them through the terrors of the war, nursing the wounded, burying the dead, comforting the bereaved, working, begging, stealing to keep food on the tables. And even now, with the Freedmen's Bureau promising all manner of wonders, they still stuck with their white folks and worked much harder than they ever worked in slave times. But the Yankees didn't understand these things and would never understand them. "Yet they set you free," she said aloud.
"No, ma'am. They didn't set me free. I wouldn't let no such trash set me free," said Peter indignantly. "I still belongs to Miss Pitty, and when I die she's gonna lay me in de Hamilton Burying Ground where I belongs. My miss gwine to be in a state when I tells her about how you let them Yankee women insult me."
"I did no such thing," cried Scarlet, startled.
"You did so, Miss Scarlet," said Peter, pushing out his lip even farther. "The point is, neither you nor me had no business being with Yankees, so they could insult me. If you hadn't talked with them, they wouldn't have had no chance to treat me like a mule or a African. And you didn't take up for me, neither."
"I did, too," said Scarlet, stung by the criticism. "Didn't I tell them you were one of the family?"
"That ain't taken up. That's just a fact," said Peter. "Miss Scarlet, you ain't got no business having no truck with Yankees.
Ain't no other ladies doing it. You wouldn't catch Miss Pitty wiping her little shoes on such trash. And she ain't gonna like it when she hear about what they say about—"
Peter's criticism hurt worse than anything Frank or Aunt Pitty or the neighbors had said,
and it so annoyed her she longed to shake the old darky until his toothless gums clapped together. What Peter said was true, but she hated to hear it from a Negro, and a family Negro, too. Not to stand high in the opinion of one's servants was as humiliating a thing as could happen to a Southerner. "A old pet," Peter grumbled. "I specs Miss Pity ain't gwine want me to drive you round no more after dat. No, ma'am." "Aunt Pity will want you to drive me as usual," she said sternly. "So let's hear no more about it."
"I'll get a misery in my back," warned Peter darkly. "My back hurtin' me so bad this minute I can't scarcely sit up. My miss ain't gwine want me to do no driving when I got a misery. Miss Scarlet, it ain't gwine do you no good to stay high with the Yankees and the white trash if your own folks don't prove of you."
That was as accurate a summing up of the situation as could be made. And Scarlet relapsed into infuriated silence. Yes, the conquerors did approve of her and her family, and her neighbors did not. She knew all the things the town was saying about her. And now even Peter disapproved of her, to the point of not caring to be seen in public with her. That was the last straw. Heretofore, she had been careless of public opinion. Careless and a little contemptuous. But Peter's words caused fierce resentment to burn in her breast, drove her to a defensive position, made her suddenly dislike her neighbors as much as she disliked the Yankees.
"Why should they care what I do?" she thought. "They must think I enjoy associating with Yankees and working like a field hand. They're just making a hard job harder for me. I don't care what they think. I won't let myself care. I can't afford to care now. But someday, someday, oh, someday, when there was security in her world again, then she would sit back and fold her hands and be a great lady as Ellen had been. She would be helpless and sheltered, as a lady should be, and then everyone would approve of her. Oh, how grand she would be when she had money again. Then she could permit herself to be kind and gentle, as Ellen had been, and thoughtful of other people and of the properties, too. She would not be driven by fears day and night, and life would be a placid, unhurried affair. She would have time to play with their children and listen to their lessons. There would be long, warm afternoons when ladies would call, and amid the rustlings of taffeta petticoats and the rhythmic harsh cracklings of palmetto fans, she would serve tea and delicious sandwiches and cakes and leisurely gossip the hours away. And she would be so kind to those who were suffering misfortune, take baskets to the poor and soup and jelly to the sick, and air those less fortunate in her fine carriage. She would be a lady in the true Southern manner, as her mother had been. And then, everyone would love her as they had loved Ellen, and they would say how unselfish she was, and call her Lady Bountiful. Her pleasure in these thoughts of the future was undimmed by any realization that she had no real desire to be unselfish, or charitable, or kind. All she wanted was the reputation for possessing these qualities. But the meshes of her brain were too wide, too coarse, to filter such small differences. It was enough that some day, when she had money, everyone would approve of her. Some day. But not now. Not now, in spite of what anyone might say of her. Now there was no time to be a great lady. Peter was as good as his word. Aunt Pity did get into a state, and Peter's misery developed overnight to such proportions that he never drove the buggy again. Thereafter, Scarlet drove alone, and the calluses which had begun to leave her palms came back again. So the spring months went by, the cool rains of April passing into the warm balm of green May weather. The weeks were packed with work and worry, and the handicaps of increasing pregnancy, with old friends growing cooler and her family increasingly more kind, more maddeningly solicitous, and more completely blind to what was driving her. During those days of anxiety and struggle, there was only one dependable, understanding person in her world, and that person was Rhett Butler. It was odd that he, of all people, should appear in this light, for he was as unstable as quicksilver and as perverse as a demon fresh from the pit. But he gave her sympathy, something she had never had from anyone and never expected from him. Frequently he was out of town on those mysterious trips to New Orleans, which he never explained, but which she felt sure, in a faintly jealous way, were connected with a woman, or women. But after Uncle Peter's refusal to drive her, he remained in Atlanta for longer and longer intervals. While in town, he spent most of his time gambling in the rooms above the Girl of the Period Saloon, or in Belle Watling's bar, hobnobbing with the wealthier of the Yankees and carpetbaggers, in money-making schemes which made the townspeople detest him even more than his cronies. He didn't call at the house now, probably in deference to the feelings of Frank and Pity, who would have been outraged at a male caller while Scarlett was in a delicate condition. But she met him by accident almost every day. Time and again, he came riding up to her buggy when she was passing through lonely stretches of Peachtree Road and Decatur Road, where the mills lay. He always drew rein and talked, and sometimes he tied his horse to the back of the buggy and drove her on her rounds. She tired more easily these days than she liked to admit, and she was always silently grateful when he took the reins. He always left her before they reached the town again, but all Atlanta knew about their meetings, and it gave the gossip something new to add to the long list of Scarlett's affronts to the proprieties. She wondered occasionally if these meetings were not more than accidental. They became more and more numerous as the weeks went by, and as the tension in town heightened over Negro outrages. But why did he seek her out, now of all times, when she looked her worst? Certainly he had no designs upon her, if he had ever had any, and she was beginning to doubt even this. It had been months since he made any joking references to their distressing scene at the Yankee jail. He never mentioned Ashley and her love for him, or made any coarse and ill-bred remarks about coveting her. She thought it best to let sleeping dogs lie, so she didn't ask for an explanation of their frequent meetings. And finally she decided that, because he had little to do besides gamble, and had few enough nice friends in Atlanta, he sought her out solely for companionship's sake. Whatever his reason might be, she found his company most welcome. He listened to her moans about lost customers and bad debts, the swindling ways of Mr. Johnson, and the incompetency of Hugh. He applauded her triumphs, where Frank merely smiled indulgently and Pity said, "Dear me," in a dazed manner. She was sure that he frequently threw business her way, for he knew all the rich Yankees and carpetbaggers intimately. But he always denied being helpful. She knew him for what he was, and she never trusted him. But her spirits always rose with pleasure at the sight of him riding around the curve of a shady road on his big black horse. When he climbed into the buggy and took the reins from her and threw her some impertinent remark, she felt young and gay and attractive again, for all her worries and her increasing bulk. She could talk to him about almost everything, with no care for concealing her motives or her real opinions. And she never ran out of things to say, as she did with Frank. Or even with Ashley, if she must be honest with herself. But of course, in all her conversations with Ashley, there were so many things which could not be said, for honor's sake, that the sheer force of them inhibited other remarks. It was comforting to have a friend like Rhett. Now that for some unaccountable reason he had decided to be on good behavior with her. Very comforting. For she had so few friends these days.
Rhett,
she asked stormily, shortly after Uncle Peter's ultimatum.
Why do folks in this town treat me so scurvily and talk about me so?
It's a toss-up who they talk worst about, me or the carpetbaggers. I've minded my own business and haven't done anything wrong, and...
If you haven't done anything wrong, it's because you haven't had the opportunity. And perhaps they dimly realize it.
Oh, do be serious. They make me so mad. All I've done is try to make a little money, and...
All you've done is to be different from other women, and you've made a little success at it. As I've told you before... That is the one unforgivable sin in any society. Be different and be damned. Scarlet, the mere fact that you've made a success of your mill is an insult to every man who hasn't succeeded. Remember, a well-bred female's place is in the home, and she should know nothing about this busy, brutal world.
But if I had stayed in my home, I wouldn't have had any home left to stay in.
The inference is that you should have starved genteelly and with pride.
Oh, fiddle-dee-dee. But look at Mrs. Merriweather. She's selling pies to Yankees, and that's worse than running a sawmill. Mrs. Elsing takes in sewing and keeps boarders, and Fanny paints awful-looking china things that nobody wants, and everybody buys to help her, and... But you miss the point, my pet.
They aren't successful. And so they aren't affronting the hot southern pride of their men folks. The men can still say, poor sweet sillies, how hard they try. Well, I'll let them think they're helping. And besides, the ladies you mentioned don't enjoy having to work. They let it be known that they're only doing it until some man comes along to relieve them of their unwomanly burdens. And so everybody feels sorry for them. But obviously, you do like to work. And obviously, you aren't going to let any man tend to your business for you, and so no one can feel sorry for you. And Atlanta is never going to forgive you for that. It's so pleasant to feel sorry for people.
I wish you'd be serious sometimes.
Did you ever hear the Oriental proverb, "The dogs bark, but the caravan passes on"? Let them bark, Scarlet. I fear nothing will stop your caravan.
But why should they mind my making a little money?
You can't have everything, Scarlet. You can either make money in your present unladylike manner and meet cold shoulders everywhere you go, or you can be poor and genteel and have lots of friends. You've made your choice.
I won't be poor, she said swiftly. But it is the right choice, isn't it?
If it's money you want most.
Yes, I want money more than anything else in the world.
Then you've made the only choice. But there's a penalty attached. As there is to most things you want. It's loneliness.
That silenced her for a moment. It was true. When she stopped to think about it, she was a little lonely. Lonely for feminine companionship. During the war years, she had had Ellen to visit when she felt blue. And since Ellen's death, there had always been Melanie, though she and Melanie had nothing in common except the hard work at Terra. Now, there was no one. For Aunt Pity had no conception of life beyond her small round of gossip.
I think... She began hesitantly. "That I've always been lonely where women were concerned. It isn't just my working that makes Atlanta ladies dislike me. They just don't like me anyway. No woman ever really liked me, except Mother, even my sisters. I don't know why. But even before the war, even before I married Charlie, ladies didn't seem to approve of anything I did.
You forget Mrs. Wilkes, said Rhett, and his eyes gleamed maliciously.
She has always approved of you up to the hilt. I dare say she'd approve of anything you did, short of murder.
Scarlet thought grimly.
She's even approved of murder.
And she laughed contemptuously.
Oh, Millie, she said,
and then ruefully.
It's certainly not to my credit that Millie's the only woman who approves of me, for she hasn't the sense of a guinea hen. If she had any sense... She stopped in some confusion.
If she had any sense, she'd realize a few things, and she couldn't approve.
Rhett finished.
Well, you know more about that than I do, of course.
Oh, damn your memory and your bad manners!
I'll pass over your unjustified rudeness with the silence it deserves, and return to our former subject. Make up your mind to this. If you are different, you are isolated, not only from people of your own age, but from those of your parents' generation, and from your children's generation, too. They'll never understand you. And they'll be shocked no matter what you do. But your grandparents would probably be proud of you and say, "There's a chip off the old block." And your grandchildren will sigh enviously and say, "What an old rip Grandma must have been." And they'll try to be like you.
Scarlet laughed with amusement. Sometimes you do hit on the truth. Now, there was my Grandma Robillard. Mammy used to hold her over my head whenever I was naughty. Grandma was as cold as an icicle and strict about her manners and everybody else's manners, but she married 3 times and had any number of duels fought over her, and she wore rouge and the most shockingly low-cut dresses and not much under her dresses.
And you admired her tremendously, for all that you tried to be like your mother.
I had a grandfather on the butler side who was a pirate. Not really. A walk-the-plank kind?
I dare say he made people walk the plank if there was any money to be made that way. At any rate, he made enough money to leave my father quite wealthy. But the family always referred to him carefully as a sea captain. He was killed in a saloon brawl long before I was born. His death was, needless to say, a great relief to his children, for the old gentleman was drunk most of the time, and when in his cups was apt to forget that he was a retired sea captain, and give reminiscences that curled his children's hair. However, I admired him and tried to copy him far more than I ever did my father. For father is an amiable gentleman full of honorable habits and pious saws. So you see how it goes. I'm sure your children won't approve of you, Scarlet, any more than Mrs. Merriweather and Mrs. Elsing and their broods approve of you now. Your children will probably be soft, prissy creatures, as the children of hard-bitten characters usually are. And to make them worse, you, like every other mother, are probably determined that they shall never know the hardships you've known. And that's all wrong. Hardships make or break people. So you'll have to wait for approval from your grandchildren.
I wonder what our grandchildren will be like.
Are you suggesting that by our, that you and I will have mutual grandchildren? Fie, Mrs. Kennedy.
Scarlet, suddenly conscious of her error in speech, went red. It was more than his joking words that shamed her, for she was suddenly aware again of her thickening body. In no way had either of them ever hinted at her condition, and she had always kept the lap-robe high under her armpits when with him, even on warm days, comforting herself in the usual feminine manner with a belief that she didn't show at all when thus covered. And she was suddenly sick with quick rage at her own condition, and shame that he should know.
"You get out of this buggy, you dirty-minded varmint," she said, her voice shaking.
I'll do nothing of the kind," he returned calmly. "It'll be dark before you get home, and there's a new colony of darkies living in tents and shanties near the next spring. Mean niggers, I've been told. And I see no reason why you should give the impulsive Ku Klux a cause for putting on their nightshirts and riding abroad this evening."
"Get out!" she cried, tugging at the reins, and suddenly nausea overwhelmed her. He stopped the horse quickly, passed her two clean handkerchiefs, and held her head over the side of the buggy with some skill. The afternoon sun, slanting low through the newly leaved trees, spun sickeningly for a few moments in a swirl of golden green. When the spell had passed, she put her head in her hands and cried from sheer mortification. Not only had she vomited before a man, in itself as horrible a contretemps as could overtake a woman, but by doing so, the humiliating fact of her pregnancy must now be evident. She felt that she could never look him in the face again. To have this happen with him, of all people, with Rhett, who had no respect for women. She cried, expecting some coarse and jocular remark from him, which she would never be able to forget. "Don't be a fool," he said quietly. "And you are a fool if you're crying for shame. Come, Scarlet, don't be a child. Surely you must know that, not being blind, I knew you were pregnant." She said, "Oh," in a stunned voice, and tightened her fingers over her crimson face. The word itself horrified her. Frank always referred to her pregnancy embarrassedly as "your condition." Gerald had been wont to say delicately, "in the family way," when he had to mention such matters, and ladies genteelly referred to pregnancy as being "in a fix." "You are a child if you thought I didn't know, for all your smothering yourself under that hot lap robe. Of course I knew. Why else do you think I've been—" He stopped suddenly, and a silence fell between them. He picked up the reins and clucked to the horse. He went on talking quietly, and as his drawl fell pleasantly on her ears, some of the color faded from her down-tucked face. "I didn't think you could be so shocked, Scarlet. I thought you were a sensible person, and I'm disappointed. Can it be possible that modesty still lingers in your breast? I'm afraid I'm not a gentleman to have mentioned the matter. And I know I'm not a gentleman, in view of the fact that pregnant women do not embarrass me as they should. I find it possible to treat them as normal creatures, and not look at the ground or the sky or anywhere else in the universe except their waistlines, and then cast at them those furtive glances I've always thought the height of indecency. Why should I? It's a perfectly normal state. The Europeans are far more sensible than we are. They compliment expectant mothers upon their expectations. While I wouldn't advise going that far, still it's more sensible than our way of trying to ignore it. It's a normal state, and women should be proud of it, instead of hiding behind closed doors as if they'd committed a crime." "Proud?" she cried in a strangled voice. "Proud? Ugh! Aren't you proud to be having a child?"
"Oh, dear God, no. I hate babies."
"You mean Frank's baby?"
"No.
Anybody's baby." For a moment she went sick again at this new error of speech. But his voice went on as easily as though he had not marked it. "Then we're different. I like babies."
"You like them?"
she cried, looking up so startled at the statement that she forgot her embarrassment.
"What a liar you are!"
"I like babies, and I like little children, till they begin to grow up and acquire adult habits of thought,
And adult abilities to lie and cheat and be dirty. That can't be news to you. You know I like Wade Hampton a lot, for all that he isn't the boy he ought to be.
That was true, thought Scarlet, suddenly marveling. He did seem to enjoy playing with Wade and often brought him presents.
Now that we've brought this dreadful subject into the light and you admit that you expect a baby sometime in the not-too-distant future, I'll say something I've been wanting to say for weeks. Two things. The first is that it's dangerous for you to drive alone. You know it. You've been told it often enough. If you don't care personally whether or not you're raped, you might consider the consequences. Because of your obstinacy, you may get yourself into a situation where your gallant fellow townsman will be forced to avenge you by stringing up a few darkies. And that will bring the Yankees down on them, and someone will probably get hanged. Has it ever occurred to you that perhaps one of the reasons the ladies do not like you is that your conduct may cause the neck stretching of their sons and husbands? And furthermore, if the Ku Klux handles many more Negroes, the Yankees are going to tighten up on Atlanta in a way that will make Sherman's conduct look angelic. I know what I'm talking about. For I'm hand in glove with the Yankees. Shameful to state. They treat me as one of them, and I hear them talk openly. They mean to stamp out the Ku Klux if it means burning the whole town again and hanging every male over 10. That would hurt you, Scarlet. You might lose money. And there's no telling where a prairie fire will stop once it gets started. Confiscation of property, higher taxes, fines for suspected women. I've heard them all suggested. The Ku Klux. Do you know any of the Ku Klux? Is Tommy Welburn or Hugh or... He shrugged impatiently. How should I know? I'm a renegade, a turncoat, a scalawag. Would I be likely to know? But I do know men who are suspected by the Yankees, and one false move from them, and they're as good as hanged. Well, I know you would have no regrets at getting your neighbors on the gallows. I do believe you'd regret losing your mills. I see by the stubborn look on your face that you do not believe me, and my words are falling on stony ground. So all I can say is keep that pistol of yours handy. And when I'm in town, I'll try to be on hand to drive you.
Brett, do you really... Is it to protect me that you...
Yes, my dear. It is my much-advertised chivalry that makes me protect you.
The mocking light began to dance in his black eyes, and all signs of earnestness fled from his face.
And why? Because of my deep love for you, Mrs. Kennedy. Yes, I have silently hungered and thirsted for you and worshipped you from afar. But being an honorable man, like Mr. Ashley Wilkes, I have concealed it from you. You are, alas, Frank's wife. And honor has forbidden my telling this to you. But even as Mr. Wilkes' honor cracks occasionally... So mine is cracking now, and I reveal my secret passion and my...
Oh, for God's sake, hush! Interrupted Scarlet, annoyed as usual when he made her look like a conceited fool, and not caring to have Ashley and his honor become the subject of further conversation. What was the other thing you wanted to tell me?
What? You changed the subject when I am bearing a loving but lacerated heart? Well... The other thing is this.
The mocking light died out of his eyes again, and his face was dark and quiet.
I want you to do something about this horse. He's stubborn, and he's got a mouth as tough as iron. Tires you to drive him, doesn't it? Well, if he chose to bolt, you couldn't possibly stop him. And if you turned over in a ditch, it might kill your baby and you too. You ought to get the heaviest curb bit you can, or else let me swap him for a gentle horse with a more sensitive mouth.
She looked up into his blank, smooth face. And suddenly her irritation fell away, even as her embarrassment had disappeared after the conversation about her pregnancy.
He had been kind a few moments before, to put her at her ease when she was wishing that she were dead. And he was being kinder now, and very thoughtful about the horse. She felt a rush of gratitude to him, and she wondered why he couldn't always be this way. "The horse is hard to drive," she agreed meekly. "Sometimes my arms ache all night from tugging at him. You do what you think best about him, Rhett." His eyes sparkled wickedly.
"That sounds very sweet and feminine, Mrs. Kennedy. Not in your usual masterful vein at all. Well, it only takes proper handling to make a clinging vine out of you."
She scowled, and her temper came back.
"You will get out of this buggy this time, or I will hit you with the whip. I don't know why I put up with you, why I try to be nice to you. You have no manners, you have no morals, you are nothing but a... Well, get out. I mean it."
But when he had climbed down and untied his horse from the back of the buggy, and stood in the twilight road, grinning tantalizingly at her, she couldn't smother her own grin as she drove off. Yes, he was coarse. He was tricky. He was unsafe to have dealings with, and you never could tell when the dull weapon you put into his hands in an unguarded moment might turn into the keenest of blades. But after all, he was as stimulating as... well, as a surreptitious glass of brandy. During these months, Scarlet had learned the use of brandy. When she came home in the late afternoons, damp from the rain, cramped and aching from long hours in the buggy, nothing sustained her except the thought of the bottle hidden in her top bureau drawer, locked against Mammy's prying eyes. Dr. Meade had not thought to warn her that a woman in her condition shouldn't drink, for it never occurred to him that a decent woman would drink anything stronger than scuppernong wine. Except, of course, a glass of champagne at a wedding, or a hot toddy when confined to bed with a hard cold. Of course, there were unfortunate women who drank, to the eternal disgrace of their families, just as there were women who were insane or divorced, or who believed, with Miss Susan B. Anthony, that women should have the vote. But as much as the doctor disapproved of Scarlet, he never suspected her of drinking. Scarlet had found that a drink of neat brandy before supper helped immeasurably, and she could always chew coffee or gargle cologne to disguise the smell. Why were people so silly about women drinking, when men could, and did get reeling drunk whenever they wanted to? Sometimes, when Frank lay snoring beside her and sleep wouldn't come, when she lay tossing, torn with fears of poverty, dreading the Yankees, homesick for Tara and yearning for Ashley, she thought she would go crazy were it not for the brandy bottle. And when the pleasant, familiar warmth stole through her veins, her troubles began to fade. After three drinks, she could always say to herself, "I'll think of these things tomorrow, when I can stand them better." But there were some nights when even brandy wouldn't still the ache in her heart. The ache that was even stronger than fear of losing the mills. The ache to see Tara again. Atlanta, with its noises, its new buildings, its strange faces, its narrow streets crowded with horses and wagons and bustling crowds, sometimes seemed to stifle her. She loved Atlanta, but, oh, for the sweet peace and country quiet of Tara, the red fields and the dark pines about it. Oh, to be back at Tara, no matter how hard the life might be, and to be near Ashley, just to see him, to hear him speak, to be sustained by the knowledge of his love. Each letter from Melanie saying that they were well, each brief note from Will reporting about the plowing, the planting, the growing of the cotton, made her long anew to be home again. "I'll go home in June. I can't do anything here after that. I'll go home for a couple of months, she thought, and her heart would rise. She did go home in June, but not as she longed to go. For early in that month came a brief message from Will that Gerald was dead. Chapter 39. The train was very late, and the long, deeply blue twilight of June was settling over the countryside when Scarlett alighted in Jonesboro. Yellow gleams of lamplight showed in the stores and houses which remained in the village, but they were few. Here and there were wide gaps between the buildings on the main street where dwellings had been shelled or burned. Ruined houses with shell holes in their roofs and half the walls torn away stared at her, silent and dark. A few saddle horses and mule teams were hitched outside the wooden awning of Bullard's store. The dusty red road was empty and lifeless, and the only sounds in the village were a few whoops and drunken laughs that floated on the still twilight air from a saloon far down the street. The depot had not been rebuilt since it was burned in the battle, and in its place was only a wooden shelter with no sides to keep out the weather. Scarlett walked under it and sat down on one of the empty kegs that were evidently put there for seats. She peered up and down the street for Will Benteen. Will should have been here to meet her. He should have known she would take the first train possible after receiving his laconic message that Gerald was dead. She had come so hurriedly that she had in her small carpet bag only a nightgown and a toothbrush, not even a change of underwear. She was uncomfortable in the tight black dress she had borrowed from Mrs. Meade, for she had had no time to get morning clothes for herself. Mrs. Meade was thin now, and Scarlett's pregnancy being advanced, the dress was doubly uncomfortable. Even in her sorrow at Gerald's death, she didn't forget the appearance she was making, and she looked down at her body with distaste. Her figure was completely gone, and her face and ankles were puffy. Heretofore she had not cared very much how she looked, but now that she would see Ashley within the hour, she cared greatly. Even in her heartbreak, she shrank from the thought of facing him when she was carrying another man's child. She loved him, and he loved her. And this unwanted child now seemed to her a proof of infidelity to that love. But much as she disliked having him see her with the slenderness gone from her waist and the lightness from her step, it was something she couldn't escape now. She patted her foot impatiently. Will should have met her. Of course she could go over to Bullard's and inquire after him, or ask someone there to drive her over to Tara, should she find he had been unable to come. But she didn't want to go to Bullard's. It was Saturday night, and probably half the men of the county would be there. She didn't want to display her condition in this poorly fitting black dress, which accentuated rather than hid her figure. She didn't want to hear the kindly sympathy that would be poured out about Gerald. She didn't want sympathy. She was afraid she would cry if anyone even mentioned his name to her. And she wouldn't cry. She knew if she once began, it would be like the time she cried into the horse's mane, that dreadful night when Atlanta fell and Rhett had left her on the dark road outside the town. Terrible tears that tore her heart and couldn't be stopped. No, she wouldn't cry. She felt the lump in her throat rising again, as it had done so often since the news came. But crying wouldn't do any good. It would only confuse and weaken her. Why? Oh, why hadn't Will or Melanie or the girls written her that Gerald was ailing? She would have taken the first train to Tara to care for him, brought a doctor from Atlanta if necessary. The fools, all of them. Couldn't they manage anything without her? She couldn't be in two places at once, and the good Lord knew she was doing her best for them all in Atlanta. She twisted about on the keg, becoming nervous and fidgety, as Will still didn't come. Where was he? Then she heard the scrunching of cinders on the railroad tracks behind her, and twisting her body, she saw Alex Fontaine crossing the tracks toward a wagon, a sack of oats on his shoulder.
"Good Lord! Isn't that you, Scarlet?"
he cried, dropping the sack and running to take her hand, pleasure written all over his bitter, swarthy little face.
"I'm so glad to see you. I saw Will over at the blacksmith shop, getting the horse shod. The train was late and he thought he'd have time. Shall I run and fetch him?"
"Yes, please, Alex," she said, smiling in spite of her sorrow. It was good to see a county face again.
Scarlet,
he began awkwardly, still holding her hand.
"I'm mighty sorry about your father."
"Thank you," she replied, wishing he had not said it. His words brought up Gerald's florid face and bellowing voice so clearly.
"If it's any comfort to you, Scarlet, we're mighty proud of him around here,"
Alex continued, dropping her hand.
"Well, we figure he died like a soldier and in a soldier's cause."
Now what did he mean by that, she thought confusedly. A soldier? Had someone shot him? Had he gotten into a fight with the scallywags as Tony had? But she mustn't hear more. She would cry if she talked about him, and she mustn't cry. Not until she was safely in the wagon with Will and out in the country where no stranger could see her. Will wouldn't matter. He was like a brother. "Alex, I don't want to talk about it," she said shortly.
"I don't blame you one bit, Scarlet," said Alex while the dark blood of anger flooded his face. "If it was my sister, Scarlet, I've never yet said a harsh word about any woman, but personally I think somebody ought to take a rawhide whip to Sue Ellen."
What foolishness was he talking about now, she wondered. What had Sue Ellen to do with it all?
"Everybody around here feels the same way about her, I'm sorry to say. Will's the only one who takes up for her, and, of course, Miss Melanie, but she's a saint, and won't see bad in anyone, and
I said I didn't want to talk about it," she said coldly, but Alex didn't seem rebuffed. He looked as though he understood her rudeness, and that was annoying. She didn't want to hear bad tidings about her own family from an outsider, didn't want him to know of her ignorance of what had happened. Why hadn't Will sent her the full details? She wished Alex wouldn't look at her so hard. She felt that he realized her condition and it embarrassed her. But what Alex was thinking as he peered at her in the twilight was that her face had changed so completely. He wondered how he had ever recognized her. Perhaps it was because she was going to have a baby. Women did look like the devil at such times. And of course she must be feeling badly about old man O'Hara. She had been his pet. But no, the change was deeper than that. She really looked better than when he had seen her last. At least, she now looked as if she had 3 square meals a day. And the hunted animal look had partly gone from her eyes. Now the eyes which had been fearful and desperate were hard. There was an air of command, assurance and determination about her, even when she smiled. But she led old Frank a merry life. Yes, she had changed. She was a handsome woman, to be sure, but all that pretty, sweet softness had gone from her face, and that flattering way of looking up at a man, like he knew more than God Almighty, had utterly vanished. Well, hadn't they all changed? Alex looked down at his rough clothes, and his face fell into its usual bitter lines. Sometimes at night when he lay awake, wondering how his mother was going to get that operation, and how poor dead Joe's little boy was going to get an education, and how he was going to get money for another mule. He wished the war was still going on, wished it had gone on forever. They didn't know their luck then. There was always something to eat in the army, even if it was just cornbread. Always somebody to give orders, and none of this torturing sense of facing problems that couldn't be solved. Nothing to bother about in the army except getting killed. And then there was Dimity Monroe. Alex wanted to marry her, and he knew he couldn't when so many were already looking to him for support. He had loved her for so long, and now the roses were fading from her cheeks and the joy from her eyes. If only Tony hadn't run away to Texas, another man on the place would make all the difference in the world. His lovable, bad-tempered little brother, penniless somewhere in the West. Yes, they had all changed. And why not? He sighed heavily. "I haven't thanked you for what you and Frank did for Tony," he said. "It was you who helped him get away, wasn't it? It was fine of you. I heard in a roundabout way that he was safe in Texas. I was afraid to write and ask you. But did you or Frank lend him any money? I want to repay—"
"Oh, Alex, please hush, not now," cried Scarlett.
For once, money meant nothing to her. Alex was silent for a moment. "I'll get Will for you," he said. "And we'll all be over tomorrow for the funeral." As he picked up the sack of oats and turned away, a wobbly-wheeled wagon swayed out of a side street and creaked up to them.
Will called from the seat.
"I'm sorry I'm late, Scarlett."
Climbing awkwardly down from the wagon, he stumbled toward her and, bending, kissed her cheek. Will had never kissed her before, had never failed to precede her name with Miss, and, while it surprised her, it warmed her heart and pleased her very much. He lifted her carefully over the wheel and into the wagon, and looking down, she saw that it was the same old rickety wagon in which she had fled from Atlanta. How had it ever held together so long? Will must have kept it patched up very well. It made her slightly sick to look at it and to remember that night. If it took the shoes off her feet or food from Aunt Pitty's table, she'd see that there was a new wagon at Terra and this one burned. Will didn't speak at first, and Scarlett was grateful. He threw his battered straw hat into the back of the wagon, clucked to the horse, and they moved off. Will was just the same, lank and gangling, pink of hair, mild of eye, patient as a draft animal. They left the village behind and turned into the red road to Terra. A faint pink still lingered about the edges of the sky, and fat, feathery clouds were tinged with gold and palest green. The stillness of the country twilight came down about them as calming as a prayer. How had she ever borne it, she thought, away for all these months, away from the fresh smell of country air, the ploughed earth, and the sweetness of summer nights. The moist red earth smelled so good, so familiar, so friendly. She wanted to get out and scoop up a handful. The honeysuckle which draped the gullied red sides of the road in tangled greenery was piercingly fragrant as always after a rain, the sweetest perfume in the world. Above their heads a flock of chimney swallows whirled suddenly on swift wings, and now and then a rabbit scurried, startled, across the road, his white tail bobbing like an eiderdown powder puff. She saw with pleasure that the cotton stood well as they passed between ploughed fields, where the green bushes reared themselves sturdily out of the red earth. How beautiful all this was! The soft gray mist in the swampy bottoms, the red earth and growing cotton, the sloping fields with curving green rows and the black pines rising behind everything like sable walls. How had she ever stayed in Atlanta so long?
"Scarlett, before I tell you about Mr. O'Hara, and I want to tell you everything before you get home, I want to ask your opinion on a matter. I figure you're the head of the house now."
"What is it, Will?"
He turned his mild, sober gaze on her for a moment.
"I just wanted your approval to my marrying Sue Ellen."
Scarlett clutched the seat so surprised that she almost fell backwards. Marry Sue Ellen? She'd never thought of anybody marrying Sue Ellen since she had taken Frank Kennedy from her. Who would have Sue Ellen? Goodness, Will!
Then I take it you don't mind?
Mind? No, but... Why, Will, you've taken my breath away.